This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to Africa News Tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jackson Vunganyi, and here is what is coming up.
If we look at the numbers of the global index for terrorism, 40% of those killed across the globe came from the Sahel. So that's concerning.
That is General Michael Langley, the head of U.S. Africa Command, on the role that extremist organizations in the Sahel play in global terrorism. Also, Rwanda says 8 people have died so far from the highly contagious Marburg virus. And today, Jimmy Carter became the first former U.S. president to reach the age of 100. All this and more coming up right here on African News Tonight. A recent study of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace showed that the United States, Russia, and China are intensifying their competition for global influence. The study says that three powers have achieved varying success in the realms of economy, security, and diplomacy. In recent decades, China has become a big player in international relations, multilateral organizations, and technological and security advancements. Amir Hamzawi, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and co-author of the study, discussed China's influence in North Africa with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi.
China has emerged in the last decade to become a trade and infrastructure giant. China has become the trading partner number one for, without an exception, all North African countries, coming ahead of the U.S. as well as ahead of different European countries, even when taken together. China has also come to be a key diplomatic partner, calling on North African countries to enter into multilateral organizations headed or backed by China. The BRICS is an example. The Shanghai Security Conference is a second example. China has also actually embarked on deploying military capabilities. China has a military base in Djibouti, which is its first ever military base outside of the mainland. And China has become active in diplomatic mediation efforts with varying degrees of success, be it with regard to the Gaza war, which impacts North Africa, or with regard to the Yemen civil war, in which China mediated between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the Yemen war has had huge impacts on the Horn of Africa and North Africa as well. China is also playing a big role in mediation between different parties in the Sudanese civil war, however, to a very limited success until now. So China has definitely advanced to become a competing great power in the region.
China consistently expanded its economic and diplomatic ties with North Africa and African countries without developing significant military ties. How did this enhance Chinese influence in Africa?
China and North Africa has focused primarily on the trade and the infrastructure part of matters in its bilateral as well as multilateral relations with different countries in the region. China is a big player in Algerian and Egyptian infrastructure projects. China is a big player in Morocco. In different sectors of the green economy in Morocco, China is a big player in solar and wind energy facilities. China is a big player in Tunisia. China has indeed not deployed military capabilities to North Africa. However, China has increased its military arms sales to the region. So its arms sales to Egypt and to Algeria, especially to these two countries, have been on the rise. So China, although it has remained primarily focused on trade, energy, infrastructure, investment opportunities, it has also expanded its portfolio. China is now increasingly becoming a key technology partner for the region as well. So whatever you're finding as Algeria or Egypt, difficulties in getting, be it 5G cellular phone networks or different AI tools or whatever you're finding difficult to get from Western companies, China is always ready to offer at a lower price, sometimes with strings attached.
The study quotes the Arab Barometer public opinion polls, indicating that favorability of China was slightly higher than the favorability of Russia or the United States in North Africa. Can you explain why?
And I believe there are two key factors to explain this phenomenon. Number one, the fact that China is not involved in any active war or any active military conflict in the region, unlike the U.S., which has continued to interfere militarily in different places, not in North Africa, but in regions which which are of significance for North African countries, of course, in the Middle East primarily. It's also unlike Russia, which has been actively involved in the Libyan civil war and is indirectly involved in the Sudanese civil war as of now. So the second factor explaining it is the fact that diplomatically, China does say what North African publics would like to hear regarding peace mediation to settle the Arab-Israeli or the Arab-Palestinian conflict, regarding nonviolent conflict resolution measures as they pertain to Yemen, Sudan, Libya. The fact that China has advanced to become a power of diplomacy, a power of peaceful mediation, speaks well to Arab publics in North Africa, which have been suffering for a very long time of aftermath of armed conflicts and violent encounters.
That was Amel Hamzawi, director of the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with my VOA colleague, Mohammed Elshenawi. Since the United States completed its military withdrawal from Niger last month, the head of U.S. Africa Command says the U.S. is resettling in West Africa to try to help partners there fight the growing terror threat in the region. General Michael Langley sat down exclusively with VOA Pentagon correspondent Kalabab to share his concerns and hopes for the Africa-led fight against Islamist militants.
The only real success I've really seen is across the Sahel, is right there in the tri-border region, and it's the Multinational Joint Task Force. And this is with Cameroon, with Chad, with Nigeria. Niger used to be in, but you know, of course there are alliance of Sahelian states now post the coup.
Could southern Libya be a solution to this Sahel challenge that you have? Is that something you're looking at as a potential solution?
We've affected the conversation. This is very much in the diplomatic realm. So we engage with the two military sides and the GNU and the LNA leadership because we need to affect unity. We need to affect unity to move forward. You know, for us to fully be able to support building their capacity to fight terrorism, anything emanating from the Sahel, we do need them in agreement, in concert, work together as a joint force. But I will tell you, you know, there is another elephant in the room, elephant in that country, and it's the Russian Federation. And so their activities are irrespective of the law of armed conflict, irrespective of rules-based order, irrespective to human rights. So we want to be the preferred partner. We don't tell them to choose. Both the GNU and LNA understand that, and they have made overtures that they do want to work with us. So we're in the nascent stages, but they need to address the political impasse that they have between the East and the West. And so our State Department is working that effort.
How big is Russia's Africa Corps?
I don't have a particular numbers that they've introduced to Mali, limited numbers in Burkina Faso and also in Libya. It's in the hundreds, I'll just put it that way. It's not extensive just yet.
Some critics have looked at the terror threat now in West Africa and how bad it is. And they point to France and they point to the United States and they point to Germany and others. And they say that the West has failed the Sahel. Do they have a valid argument?
If we look at the numbers in the global index for terrorism, 40% of those killed across the globe came from the Sahel. So that's concerning. It emanated from the ideology, I would say, emanated down through Syria, through the Maghreb. Arab Spring contributed to it. The fall of Libya contributed to it. That's how that it's grown and metastasized to the numbers you have today. But those that are joining those ranks are very few foreign fighters. They're indigenous to these countries. So that ideology, that caliphate, if you will, that jihad-type ideology is preying upon the civil society, preying upon the military-age males. as we're resetting counterterrorism. Of course, you know, we pulled out of Niger, but we are engaging with coastal West Africa countries because if we look at the what direction is metastasized on the northern regions of Cote d'Ivoire, of Ghana, and Togo, and Benin. They understand the enduring solution for terrorism is not about kinetics. So, and they, too, come up with the whole of government approach to collectively come up with a solution set of engaging with the youth that are very vulnerable to joining one of these caliphates or jihadist-type organizations.
That was General Michael Langley, the head of U.S. Africa Command, speaking with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Rwanda says 8 people have died so far from the highly contagious Marburg virus. Reuters News reports the announcement comes just days after the country declared an outbreak of the deadly hemorrhagic fever, which has no authorized vaccine or treatment. Like Ebola, the Marburg virus originates in fruit bats and spreads between people through close contact with the bodily fluids of infected individuals. Rwanda declared an outbreak on Friday, and a day later, the first 6 deaths were reported. Health Minister Sabin Nsanzimana said Sunday night so far 26 cases have been confirmed and 8 of the sickened people have died. The public has been urged to avoid physical contact to help curb the spread. About 300 people who came into contact with those confirmed to have the virus have also been identified, and an unspecified number of them have been put in isolation facilities. You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. We'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. Jimmy Carter is the first U.S. president to reach the age of 100. VOA's Ken Farabaugh has more from Georgia on the historic milestone.
America. It was a celebration fit for a centenarian. And I call you by your name. The Fox Theater in Atlanta hosted dozens of musical acts and thousands of guests for a concert celebrating the 100th birthday of Georgia's former governor and U.S. president, Jimmy Carter.
And it's a way to be together, and I think that is who he is fundamentally.
Jason Carter believes the concert, featuring some performers who campaigned for his grandfather in the 1970s, is a unifying and bipartisan way to celebrate what one documentary film director calls the rock and roll president.
That brings people together across geographies, across culture, across any sort of racial dividing lines. I mean, you'll have Democrats, Republicans in here tonight.
One person noticeably absent from the celebration was Jimmy Carter himself. He remains in hospice care at his home, a town 240 kilometers south of Atlanta.
It's a 600-person village in the middle of nowhere, and all of his other work at the end of the road in Africa has been in those same kinds of 600-person villages, and he feels a kinship there, he feels a connection there, and I think the way that he marks this moment is by being at home.
Jimmy Carter celebrates his historic birthday milestone quietly at his home here in Plains, Georgia, where on October 1st, 1924, Lillian Carter gave birth to the first U.S. president born in a hospital.
But the only reason he was born in a hospital was because his mother was working that day.
Jill Stuckey is a Carter family friend who serves as superintendent of the Jimmy Carter National Historical Park, which includes his preserved Depression-era boyhood farm, the Old Plains High School, where he studied, and the railroad depot that he converted into his campaign headquarters in his successful 1976 White House bid.
Of course, a lot of them head straight to peanut butter ice cream.
Stuckey says Plains celebrates their famous neighbor every day, but this historic birthday is marked by serving others.
We're naturalizing 100 new citizens in his honor.
Carter's milestone is a bittersweet occasion in Plains. It's the first spent without his wife, Rosalind, who passed away last November.
77 and a half years of marriage, to be without your soulmate, you know, it's very, very tough times.
The birthday celebration, which began at the Fox Theater in September and ends in Plains October 1st, brought Carter's large extended family together, including his great-grandson, Charlie Carter.
You'll probably never be to a bigger birthday party, right?
No. Maybe it's 101.
Carter also holds the record for the longest post-presidential career. Since departing the White House in 1981, he and his wife founded the Atlanta-based global nonprofit Carter Center, which fights neglected tropical diseases, promotes peaceful conflict resolution, and monitors elections around the world, causes which led him to be awarded the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
In the U.S. election campaign, vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz meet Tuesday for their first and only debate. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at what to expect when the candidates meet in New York.
Go back to San Francisco. No one's because there. She is...
Tim Walz and J.D. Vance will debate on television for 90 minutes Tuesday with two moderators and no live audience. Vance is a U.S. senator from the Midwest state of Ohio who's running with Donald Trump. He says the debate is a chance to show how Republicans will improve the economy and secure the border.
It's an opportunity for me to get to tell the American people how I think we can make their lives better and how Donald Trump's policies can make them more prosperous, can make the world more peaceful, and can secure that southern border. If we do those things, we're going to win.
Walz is governor of the Midwest state of Minnesota and is running with Kamala Harris. He says Democrats are looking out for working class Americans, unlike his opponent.
Like all regular people I grew up with in the heartland, J.D. studied at Yale, had his career funded by Silicon Valley billionaires, and then wrote a bestseller trashing that community. Come on! That's not what middle America is. And I gotta tell you, I can't wait to debate the guy.
Vance is a one-time Trump critic who won the former president's endorsement for his Senate run. Vance has since aligned himself with Trump's America First approach.
Now our enemies and a lot of Democrats call us populists, like it's something of an insult. But if being a populist means being on the side of working people rather than the powerful elites who hollowed out our middle class and sent us into stupid foreign wars, then sign me up.
Vance recently told European leaders they need to pay more to help Ukraine fight off the Russian invasion. Walz says Vance and Trump mean to relinquish U.S. leadership.
When Republicans used to talk about freedom, many of them actually meant it. They weren't going to turn their backs on our allies. They weren't going to leave Ukraine to themselves.
Vance says Harris is hurting working Americans in favor of illegal immigrants.
What Kamala Harris seems to want to do is to give all the benefits of American citizenship to people who shouldn't even be here, and that's going to bankrupt this country and make it impossible for normal people to afford to buy a home, to afford to buy groceries, to benefit from that social safety net.
Walz says Trump's career in business and in politics shows he's only looking out for rich people like him.
Rig the economy for those at the top and screw the people at the bottom. That's what they do. Your costs go up. They repeal the Affordable Care Act and bring us back to pre-existing conditions. They cut Social Security and Medicare, the very things that keeps my mom out of poverty.
Tuesday's matchup is the last scheduled debate before the November 5th election, with early voting already underway in some states. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Americans are getting ready to vote this fall in what promises to be very close presidential race. Like most Americans, members of the African diaspora community face a stark choice when deciding which direction the country should go. Jeff Swicord spoke with both a Trump and Harris supporter to get a sense of their very different life experiences.
A special July 4th celebration for 89-year-old Sylvina Goods. Today, along with many others from around the globe, she will become an American citizen in a ceremony on the grounds of Mount Vernon, the colonial home of George Washington, the first president of the United States.
Merci, Nunez. I was neither Portuguese nor American, since I have been living here for so many years. So why not be an American citizen? So now my status is settled.
Then I will perform work.
Silvina left her native Portugal almost 20 years ago for the U.S. Like most Americans, she has been following developments in the U.S. presidential election and will be voting for the first time this November.
I follow politics on radio and TV, and I follow the debates. In fact, I followed the last one on Univision. For me, it is important because I learn what they think about their ideas and what they would do.
Iran, Ireland.
As a new U.S. citizen, she feels empathy for those who want to come to the United States.
I think they should come, respecting the laws of the country and the people who live here, so they should come legally.
Silvina is a Catholic, but when it comes to abortion, she believes in a woman's right to choose.
I think there should be respect for oneself, but sometimes it is necessary because men sometimes don't respect women. There should be more respect for women, but there isn't. So abortion exists, and exists all over the world.
In Portugal, she worked in the social services arena and believes a strong social safety net is important in any country.
Above all, social assistance is important for people of the lower class, especially the ones who have a lot of kids.
When we first spoke with her in July, her impression of former President Trump was that he's too impulsive. She thought President Biden showed calmness and strength.
Hi.
Now that Vice President Harris has entered the race, she thinks she has the profile to be president. She told us she's neither flashy or rude and will be voting for her this November. Other first-time voters we've spoken to intend to vote for Trump, believing he is the right man for the job with the decisive leadership style they feel is necessary for the country. Today, politics is set aside as she celebrates her new citizenship with her family. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Mount Vernon, Virginia.
A Tunisian court sentenced presidential candidate Ayachi Zamel to 12 years in prison yesterday on charges of falsifying documents, his lawyer said. Reuters says it's the third prison sentence imposed on Zamel in 2 weeks and was announced 5 days before the presidential election. One more person has died from mass shootings at two houses in a South African village over the weekend, bringing the death toll to 18. Reuters reports police are still searching for the assailants who opened fire Saturday on people who had reportedly gathered for a family event in Lasikisiki village in Eastern Cape Province. The shootings, which took place in two houses on the same street, fueled outrage over a recent spate of mass shootings in the country. The motive for the killings remains unknown, and police said on Monday that no arrests have been made. South Africa has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. Police recorded 12,734 homicides in the first 6 months of this year. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.